Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check.
Welcome to the Quick Restart. We cover 73 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
And we do it fast.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Quinn Kesnick, who is fresh off of calling the ACC semifinals. It was part of a weekend of college lacrosse that I think stands as alone as one of the best in recent memory. Quint, what a weekend of action. How do you try to put it into context?
Well, I just think it's indicative of what we've seen for most of the season. I thought maybe the last 2 or 3 weeks things settled down. But and I think it's a forerunner or a foreshadowing of what's going to happen this upcoming weekend and then in the NCAA tournament. Great action this weekend in terms of goal scoring and goal scoring runs and comebacks and impactful games that went down to the last 5 minutes. The fans were really treated to some good ball.
And for me, that last point that you hit on is absolutely what separated it. The late game winning goals, starting with the noon games on Saturday, particularly Jeff Teat feeding Clark Peterson with 4 seconds remaining, Asher Nolting running down the clock out of a timeout with less than a minute to go and scoring on a rocker step with, like, I think like 13 seconds left, something like that. Providence scoring late to send the game to overtime and then scoring off of the opening faceoff in overtime. Robert Morris with a upset over Hobart in overtime. Virginia with Ian Laviano's goal inside of a minute. And then Penn State with Jack Kelly's goal inside of a minute. It was unreal. It just it felt like it had a March Madness buzzer beater vibe to it. The type of thing that you don't see with nearly the frequency that we saw yesterday in college lacrosse. It was really, really special. But because you were on hand in Chapel Hill to see both Virginia's win over the Tar Heels and Notre Dame's win over Duke, let's start there. But before we do, for those of you that weren't able to see, the action started fast and furious on Thursday night when it looked like Syracuse had a game in hand, and then North Carolina reeled off 4 straight goals, including 3 in the span of 45 seconds, to end the Orange's ACC tournament earlier than it looked like it was going to. The hosts then played nip and tuck throughout against Virginia before, like I mentioned, a comeback, a goalie change at halftime, and Ian Laviano putting in the game winner. How did that first game unfold from your perspective?
Seems like it was 10 years ago. You know, I thought Virginia played good at the beginning and good at the end. And in between, they weren't very good at all. When you think about their lead early, 4-1, 6-3 at the end of the first quarter, and then they went dormant for 26 minutes and 17 seconds. They shot 0-for-11 in the second quarter. Carolina went to that backer zone defense where they put the shorty inside, and it throttled Virginia's offense to the point where they trailed 10-6. And, you know, that middle part of the game, Carolina dominated. And then Virginia turned it on with Docs Aiken in the fourth quarter, down 3, 12-9. They finished the game on, what, a 6-1 run, I think it was. Yeah, it's a 6-1 run to claim the victory. I thought Matt Moore was great early. Docs was great late. Laviano was outstanding all throughout the game. Krause wasn't his normal self. That's, well explained by his ankle injury. But, again, Virginia needs somebody else to step up in terms of scoring. Their transition game is not as wicked as it could be. They're getting nice face-off play from Petey LaSala, and the goalie situation is an impending absolute dumpster fire. So I'm not sure what to think of this Virginia team. They'll host for the ACC Finals. They get a week to prepare for that. It's just ideal spacing. I worry about teams who lost this ACC semis, what they're going to do with all their time. You think about Duke, Syracuse. That's a long time to get ready. They're not going to play till May 11th or 12th. It's 2 weeks. Like, I don't know what to do if I was a coach, how you'd schedule that out. And this is a bad time of year to have kids off. I mean, there's a lot of distractions going on.
No doubt. You mentioned Matt Moore, and his 1-goal-6-assist performance really stands out to me for a couple reasons. The first being that he was a midfielder last year. His move to attack was well documented in the early part of the season. And for me, that playmaking was kind of I don't want to say it was going to be what separated him in terms of whether this decision ended up being fruitful in the long run, but I think if you're Virginia, particularly offensive coordinator Sean Kerwin, that type of stat line is a vindicating – it's vindication for the decision.
Well, hold it there a second. Well, a little, but look, I love the kid. He's playing great. He's a really, really talented player, and his ability to be versatile and to morph into this attack role is exceptional. But Carolina was switching on all picks. They were switching a shorty onto him in that first quarter. It's like, what are you doing? And next thing you know, he had four assists in that first quarter. They were willing to like play their worst defender on Virginia's most dangerous ball carrier. That was a brainless defensive strategy. Thankfully, they changed it, and then you saw what happened. As I said, Virginia went scoreless for over 26 minutes. So I don't know why switching on all picks is standard in their system, and that backfired in their face in that first quarter.
North Carolina extended their season with their Thursday win over Syracuse, bumped their RPI up to number 16, added a second quality win. You said during the broadcast that you thought that they would be firmly on the bubble with a win over Virginia. They didn't get it. It seems like they're pretty far off the bubble, if alive at all, with their regular season concluded. So assuming they don't make the NCAA tournament, what is the postscript, in your opinion, for this 2019 Tar Heel season?
Confusing season for the Tar Heels, where their schedule is not what it used to be, and they lost close games early to Denver and Johns Hopkins. They tried to play fast and be NASCAR lacrosse early in the season. That didn't work, and then they turned into stall ball. And this version that we saw in the last two games where they throw the ball around the outside for 45 seconds and then go to the goal to protect their defense was an entirely different style of ball that they played earlier in the year. And it seemed to fit this group better. They're not very deep on defense. If you're going to play in NASCAR, you need like four good shorties. You need two poles. You need four close defensemen. You need a goalie who can outlet, a goalie who can make stops. And they weren't getting that early in the year. Now, you know, Caton Johnson's kind of a game changer for them late in the season. They'll have to just reevaluate. What's their style? What's their identity? I'm not quite sure they knew at the end of the year. You know, they found that winning games by playing slow was maybe what it took. And does that continue next year? I'm not sure.
You mentioned something interesting with their schedule. And when you look at it in aggregate, and this has been the case the last two seasons, they play a lot of teams whose RPIs are outside of the top 40. And then they play a lot of teams whose RPIs are in the top 10. And there's not a lot in between, and it's those teams that are in between that Carolina can beat that can be in contention to become a quality win, that they need to add those teams to their schedule, because really the only one that fits into that category this year is Johns Hopkins, and that was a one-goal loss. If that result was flipped, I think Carolina would be still in consideration, and if they had another one in that echelon, I think that
they would
be even better. Well,
consider Denver in that echelon?
No, well, traditionally, I would consider them to be a top 10 team. I don't expect Carolina to beat Denver more times than they don't. And so as a result, I think you need to add one or two teams who you will year in and year out be favored then, but that team is in a position to consistently be a top 20 win.
Yeah, it's a good point. So Carolina finishes the year RPI 16 this week. You know, that ACC 4-5 game, a little controversial. There's some Syracuse fans who are no fans of that game, but it'll exist again next year. And that tournament next year is going to – I forget where they're playing it, but they've already decided they stay with that format for one more year.
Right.
That's all I know.
And in the nightcap, Notre Dame, 12-10 victors over Duke. For me, this was a game that I picked Notre Dame primarily because – even though Duke has had Notre Dame's number in this series, by and large, it's amazing. I thought that stat to open the broadcast, they played 19 times in this decade, was outrageous and so eye-opening. But this was a game that I felt like Notre Dame needed more. You have hammered into my brain that Duke doesn't care about, and when I say that, I put it in quotation marks, but they don't care about winning the ACC tournament. They care.
I think they
care
this year, though. That's a funny thing.
All right, so go on, because that's what I want to hear.
Well, no, in the past, there was really no benefit. Obviously, not playing for an AQ. You know, there is the cachet of being ACC champs. But schedule-wise, to play two games the week before the NCAA tournament was never – or actually – for some reason, John Danowski, I think, always felt de-emphasized the ACC tournament. That's all. That was my point. I didn't feel that was the case this year, though. I felt like this is a team that changed the way they played offense, and he wanted to see them dig down and play a great game, and they did not for a variety of reasons. What do you say?
Matt Schmidt finished with 18 saves, and I didn't feel like he was outrageously good. I thought it was really interesting because obviously Notre Dame has not been consistent with their goalie play so far this year, running out Jack Zavallo at times. And it's really, I mean, it's been like 6 or 7 years since they've gotten consistent 55% and above goalie play. I felt like what Schmidt showed against Duke was that is what you want to see. That is what you expect to see from a Notre Dame goaltender. But at the same time, it didn't feel like a traditional two-thirds saves type day because there weren't like a ton of the highlight reels, stolen goals type situation. It was just like, no, he made the saves that defense is designed to he made saves on the shots that defense is designed to give up, and Duke settled to take those shots a lot. And that was settled, the way I saw the game unfold.
And you think about what's changed all offseason. We said, oh, the shot clock will help Notre Dame. The shot clock will help their defense. That hasn't been the case, but I thought it did help them in this game. I thought Duke was, because of Notre Dame's great defense, their gap control, they were pinching to deny that inside pass and the backdoor feed that had crushed them in the regular season game. That wasn't there as much. They held their matchups better. They got better midfield defense on Nakai Montgomery. They rotated a pole up to Brad Smith. Nothing caught them off guard. They made the adjustments. And then Schmidt made the saves that you hope a goalie of Notre Dame quality can make. And he made one or two really extra saves, which is a bonus.
Yep.
And I mean, I think I said it early in the show. I'm like, that's a 7-5 team. That's a lot better than a 7-5 team. They've played in spurts this season. They've gotten horrible goaltending going into that game. I mean, what was he, 40% going into that game?
Yeah.
With that kind of defense, he has struggled. So I feel great for the kid. It was 46%. You know, 5-3 was his overall record. He was a highly recruited kid. He's got some ability. He's only a sophomore, dealing with a slump, and he bounced out of it. And so I got a lot of respect for him and Coach Anderson and them going back to work and figuring it out. That's part of this deal. You know, it's not easy, and you're going to go through your ups and your downs. So I give him a lot of credit, and let's see if he can keep it rolling because he was really pumped up at the end of that game. You could see it. And he deserves it. You know, you earn this kind of thing. And I think Notre Dame's extremely dangerous. As I thought all week I was texting you. I'm like, the more film I watched on them, the more they got good offensive players. They really do. I mean, Wheaton Jacobois is very underrated. That kid can do a little bit of everything. His stats are balanced.
He's tall.
Everybody knows Costabile and Gleason. Connor Morin is becoming a really dynamic player. He didn't have a great game the other day, but you plug in his goals from this year. And then, you know, they got athletes. This kid McCann, they love on defense. He's got great feet. Griffin Westland's going to be a nice player. The Meyer kid has some nice isolation goals. Nick Stinn gets minutes. I just like what I see. The more I dug, the more I liked what I saw from Notre Dame. And I think they deserve a second chance now towards the postseason.
Do you think that Duke gave Brian Costabile enough respect?
No. Well, I mean, do they give up those shots typically? I don't know, but he had time to set his feet and rip, and that's not ideal defense. You know, obviously JT Giles Harris wasn't there in the second half. That's a story for another day. But they didn't lose that game on the defensive side of the field, I don't think. They lost it with their lack of dodgers, their lack of penetrators on offense. And I'm really worried about this group going forward. I mean, who can get to the goal?
Yeah, I mean,
besides Brad Smith and Nakai Montgomery, who can get to the goal?
You guys talked about it on the show, and I thought that it was a point really well made. They don't have a third consistent dodger.
Yeah, and all of a sudden it kind of hit me like, wow, this team's going to have to create some offense somehow. Now, how do they do it? And they'll find answers. Is it pick and rolls? Is it invert? Is it heavy motion? Is it through sets? Or do they turn up the heat in terms of their transition game? Because they can run and they can score in transition. It's hard, you know, when they're playing so much defense and not making consistently great, you know, stops and outlets. But I'm not sure about Duke going forward. I mean, my biggest takeaways from the weekend were – Duke, Maryland, and Syracuse. Three teams a week ago I thought could win a national title. All of a sudden I'm saying, wait a second, I got to reevaluate Duke, Maryland, and Syracuse this week. And if so, that leaves me with a much smaller group of teams who can win the title. And if that's the case, then really the pool is even gigantic. Because right. if you got this thing down to one or two teams and they stub their toe, that means anybody can win it.
Yep.
So I went from like a big pool to a small pool, and that's where I'm at right now, a small pool. But if you have a tiny pool, like I was just saying, I think that means it's kind of wide open.
Well, let's go ahead and hear from Notre Dame head coach Kevin Corrigan.
We were just focused on making the next play, you know, I mean, because of what you're saying, you know, I mean, like, you never felt like any lead was going to be like, okay, we've scored enough now, you know, we're good to go, you know, so you just, you know, just, whether it's offensive or defensive, just make the next play, because you knew it's going to take a few more plays to win the game, because they're a great team, it doesn't stop, so, and they got a lot of different weapons. You know, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, we got some saves today that we didn't get in the first go around, and that's huge, you know. I mean, that's there's no, you know, there's just no discounting how big a factor goaltending is in our sport, right? And so that was big. But I also felt like we gave up more shots of the type that we wanted to give up than we did the first time around, you know. So that makes a big difference too, you know. If you're giving up shots on the doorstep all day, it's hard for your goalie to kind of get a rhythm and get confident, you know. Well, I mean, you know, Charlie's just a battler. I mean, I'm telling you, I've never seen anybody just kind of will themselves into being a really good, productive player the way I've seen Charlie Leonard do it over the last 3 years. So nothing but great respect and admiration for him and what he does. And, you know, we know if nothing else, he's going to go out there and give us the absolute best effort that he has every single faceoff. There's just nothing. He's not capable of anything else, you know, even in practice. He just doesn't know another way. A better job of defending on the initial, you know, off the dribble, you know, if you will, but then not sliding so crazy. We got too excited in the first game, and you know, we almost were too worried about too many of their guys, so we were sliding to them all the time. And you know, they move the ball so well that if you start sliding and the ball starts moving, you never catch up again. You know what I mean? Like it's just you're just chasing them from behind then. So you really got to try to be disciplined and do better than that. But it starts with the first guy guarding the ball. If he's getting toasted, you have to go, you know, and then the ball starts popping. So both of those things together, I think, are the key. And then getting the stop at the end, you know? I mean, I lose track of Brian because he makes so many plays for us that I couldn't tell you whether he had two or six. That's just the way, you know, We count on him. He's got a skill, but he's also got like a physical toughness that he takes, you know, a lot of shots in the course of a game. You know, physically he takes, you know, takes hits and does that and just keeps going kind of relentlessly to the goal, you know. So like I say, I sometimes lose track of how many different plays he's making for us. I mean, that's the thing, you know. While Brian might be at the end of some plays, I mean, the fact that we have, you know, we're putting six and eight guys out there who can all make plays makes a big difference, you know. I mean, if a team can load up, which I felt like early in the year, there was a period during the year where they were loading up on Gleason and Costabile, and we weren't doing a good enough job as coaches to get the other guys to recognize that and to see the plays that were there for them to make, you know. So I think we've all come along in that, and now we're getting those contributions from those other guys. It makes it hard to sit on Costabile or sit on Gleason and take away those guys, you know.
All right, Quint, as I mentioned at the top, the noon window, which I was responsible for on InsideTheCross.com, I ended up writing the game stories for Cornell's win over Princeton and High Point's win over Richmond. It was just chock full of action. And that Cornell-Princeton game was really eye-opening because, you know, Cornell is a team that has had its struggles all season long. A lot of it has stemmed from goalie play and the faceoff X. Defense and the faceoff X.
Yeah.
And they faced off very, very well against Princeton. I believe Paul Rasimowicz finished 22 of 27. I want to say he picked up 18 ground balls. And yet they couldn't find an answer to Michael Sowers. He finished with 7 goals and an assist. In so doing, passing the 100-goal mark for his career and I believe becoming the all-time leading scorer in Princeton lacrosse history with 248 points. Just an outrageous day for Sowers, and it showed that Cornell doesn't have that number one defender who can lock down the opposing team's best attackman. And yet, Cornell got hot late. They went on a 5-1 run in the fourth quarter, and they put themselves in a position for a game-winning goal that actually, to me, when Jeff Teat missed a 5-yard shot with about 7 seconds left, and I believe Cornell, I can't recall whether they called timeout after that or the sequence leading up to that, and then they scored off the end line restart. But I was like, oh man, if this goes to overtime, I do not feel good, despite how good they're playing at the faceoff X. I do not feel good about Cornell's momentum. And of course, it was something that Cornell fans have gotten very accustomed to over the last 3 years. Jeff Teat to Clark Peterson, game winner, 4 seconds to go. It was just an outrageous play, an outrageous end to the rivalry, and crystallized the Ivy League picture as number one seed Penn will take on number four seed Brown, and Yale and Cornell will rematch of their March 17-8 Yale victory in New Haven as the other semifinal.
I'm heading up to the Big Apple. Game's on Friday, 6 and 8:30, kind of a late Friday night at Columbia.
Yeah, but it's a city that never sleeps, so you'll be able to find a watering hole to go to afterwards.
Northern tip of Manhattan, Robert Kraft Field, and it's going to be good. It's, you know, the Cornell Yale game, the second game, should be epic. It'll be interesting to see Penn now as a number one seed. Going back to Princeton, you know, I mean, what a year. Preseason number 14 in the country, coming off a great end to 2018 when they won 5 in a row. But you go back to their Denver win, and you thought, wow, this team just turned the corner. They beat Denver on national TV on a Tuesday afternoon. And then they followed that up with a loss at Brown, lost to Brown. And unfortunately, you know, the fans are ripped off here. They don't get to see Michael Sowers really play. And I feel bad for him because he's surrounded by a nice little offense, but the rest of the team is quite honestly not very good. And this is a great player. One of the best maybe in program history who's never going to play in a monumental, epic game, right?
I mean, honestly, reminds me of Tom Schreiber as well.
Yeah.
That's a conversation for another time, and there are probably some other aspects of it that we can get into as well. But for me, you know, hard to feel great about this result if you're Cornell in any other way than just survive in advance.
Yeah, survive in advance, exactly. Princeton beat them last year, so I thought Cornell, you know, they are who they are. If they get possessions, they're going to score. And they showed some guts, they showed some heart, and they're alive. To me, they're in the at-large mix as a bubble team, but man, if you beat Yale, you're basically in the tournament. If you lose, I'm not so sure. So, you know, that's interesting. That's Friday-Sunday format, final Sunday noon on ESPNU. There's a lot of these leagues this year are televised. I sent you guys that. Hopefully you'll put that on the website for all the fans sometime this week.
The other game that I mentioned, High Point versus Richmond, sealed the number one seed for the predetermined host Panthers. They will take on Jacksonville in the first semifinal, and in the other semifinal, Richmond will play Air Force. The Falcons get the number two seed. This was a game in which the Spiders got out to a 3-0 start, and High Point had to dig themselves out of a hole. A couple of controversial, shall we say, crease calls. One, a astronauting dive that for me was a clear push, got flagged as a push, as a matter of fact, and yet the unsportsmanlike was given to Nolting, goal taken off. And then later in the game, I believe in the third quarter, there was a no-goal crease call on High Point that yielded a Mish Savaka transition tally for Richmond, and yet the Panthers were able to overcome those two. I thought for Richmond, it was a really nice offensive performance, well-rounded. I thought defensively, they just couldn't put the clamps on Nolting. He had a great day with 7 points. I thought that High Point, you know, you would have wanted to see them control this game when you looked at the box score and saw how well Tim Trautner played in goal and how well Davis St. Pierre played at the faceoff X. And you wonder if a rematch were to come about, would the outcome shift? Meaning, does Richmond get a couple of more plays in order to seal the victory? Do they get a little bit better performance out of Jack Russ Bolton and at the faceoff X? Or does High Point turn that, you know, special teams one-sidedness into a more lopsided victory. But that's a story that'll be written this weekend. So it'll be an interesting one to watch.
I want to ask you about High Point. 12 wins this year. They've won their last five straight, which is a really nice accomplishment after losing to Jacksonville March 23rd. That's who they play in the semifinals, so I think that's an easy game for them to get up for. They're playing at home. They can score, man. This team gets the teens like every week, but all of a sudden they're giving up teens. The last three games they've given up 16, 15, 14. Okay, their RPI today on Sunday is 19. They've got two wins that very few teams in the country have over Duke and Virginia. Yet we kind of push them to the side now when it comes to at large with their loss to St. John's. That was in February, late February. Do you think they're still in the mix? Do you think they're still sniffing around that at-large pile?
It's interesting because if they were to play either Richmond or Air Force and then play the other one, if they were to play one in the semis and one in the title game, I could imagine their RPI rising as high as 16.
I was going to say 16, yeah.
Yeah, there's a big gap between 15
What's
and
the
16.
Threshold, Terry, historically?
12. 12. 12 is the It is not the record low, but it is on a year-to-year basis the lowest team to get an at-large bid has an RPI of 12. So it's a long way further to go. But that's I've been saying this since the first bracketology. It's very rare that the last team in has two top five wins, which is what wins over Duke and Virginia are right now. And so point being that by virtue of playing Jacksonville in the semifinals, whose RPI is in the 40s, I expect High Points to fall out of the top 20, which for me is that's the determining line for are you even in consideration. If you are not a top 20 RPI team, I don't think you merit or receive legitimate at-large selection consideration, and I think that that's essentially how this season's going to shake out. So for me, I think that the question of High Point's resume really comes down to seeding. Where would they go? Would they be able to avoid Duke in the first round if they were to win the SoCon AQ? And if so, and ultimately, that was based on my bracketology that was done before they lost to Notre Dame. So I don't even know, where the Blue Devils are going
to
fall.
I mean, the Panthers got to be I'm thinking that we're going to be sent to Virginia or Duke.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer slotting.
Right. Which, obviously, they're not afraid of. So, but of course, they've got a lot
it's been
of work
a great season. Let's, it's been an incredible season for John Torpy and that group. Again, a dozen wins, 12-2 is the record. Those two marquee wins that really gathered everyone's attention. But now it comes down to this next week. If they finish it off, man, this will be something special.
The one
I find myself rooting for a team like this.
No question. The one guy I want to shout out because I think he's really, really underrated is junior middie Dalton Silver. He had some big goals. He's a Texas native, and everybody knows about Nolting. I think Chris Young is a well-known quantity, Canadian goal scorer, 42 on the year, and beyond that, obviously Troutner, the only goalie drafted to PLL. So they've got some well-known players. I think Dalton Silver is one who, in watching this Richmond game, I was like, man, this kid's really underrated. Moving along, which would you like to talk about next? I can't believe we're probably about 30 minutes into this podcast and we have not mentioned the rivalry. Johns Hopkins went down to College Park. At this point, I'm pretty sure that the Big Ten, by virtue of Ohio State's loss to Michigan on Friday night and then Penn State's win over Rutgers on Saturday afternoon, I believe that the Blue Jays knew that they were in the Big Ten tournament. And yet, they put in their best showing of the year, 16-11 victors over Maryland to claim the Wooden Crab. And it wasn't an easy game in the sense that they got behind early, but an 8-1 run in the second quarter proved to be too much for Maryland to bounce back from.
I found the result to be shocking. I found it to be eye-opening and shocking. Did Jim Delaney call John Tillman and say, hey, let's make the Big Ten tournament a little more interesting,
two teams,
roll over here.
Two games that were just played 4 days prior getting rematched?
Yeah. Well, I don't love the rematches, but this next Maryland Hopkins game is for all the marbles for Johns Hopkins season. So they put themselves into a situation now where they win that game. Who knows? They could even get a home game in the NCAA tournament, but I think they'd be in. You know, I've had people tell me that Maryland defense, you know, and I've watched them. It's not the same Maryland defense. I know that. But I didn't think they were that bad. That was epic. 16 goals is the most they've given up since they played Cornell back in 2013. That was eye-opening. Again, I said, you know, Duke, Maryland, Syracuse, got to wonder what's going on with Maryland's defense.
How about the fact that Johns Hopkins was able to win handily despite making only two saves?
They held them to 20 shots. How 13 outrageous. On goal, 11 of them went in. You won a game on the road against a top five opponent, and you made two saves, and you're Johns Hopkins, and you've struggled all year. It just we were watching on Clark's phone, and you know, Maryland had that early lead, and next thing you know, Hopkins get on that run, and I'm just like, wow, look at this, they're putting it together, these guys, you know, they're putting it together. I saw some new faces on the field, which was a positive. Who knows? I just give those kids a lot of credit for being able to hit the reset button, Terry, because that's difficult. You know, it's really difficult, especially at a place like Hopkins where the scrutiny is intense. It's a hot. And so you go back to practice after losing to Ohio State. You know, you got to go back to practice and you got to own that Penn State loss. And then somehow they found to move beyond that. And that's a great lesson. That's a great life lesson. You know, I talked about earlier about Matt Schmidt at Notre Dame and his struggles. Those are the type of moments that why sports are so valuable, why playing these college games and why this team now, these kids, as they become men, that's a great lesson. Gosh, and I'm just so impressed with their ability to shed the last two games because I couldn't, but you could because you picked them.
One thing that I found really fascinating was the change at the faceoff X. Cal Prouty had taken the majority of draws. I assume that they saw something in the matchup. I don't know that Prouty was injured. I assume they saw something in the matchup that made him feel like Matt Narewski had a better shot against the tandem against Maryland's tandem, and ultimately it ended up proving to be the case because he faced off really well.
Yeah, and then you move forward. So that's an area that John Tillman's got to figure out with his tablet, okay? The other is defense. You know, is it matchups? Is it their slide mentality? They've been a slow-to-go team this year. I was just surprised at how they were getting beat off the Dodge. That's just not characteristic of a Terp defense.
Well, let's go ahead and hear from the Johns Hopkins contingent of Dave Petromala, Patrick Foley, and Joey Epstein.
Good win. Versus a very, very good team, and a very important win on a lot of fronts. Forget the rivalry for a second. Forget the rivalry trophy. You know, for our season and on the national landscape, this was really important. Proud of our guys. I thought they did a good job. I thought we played team ball today. Still didn't play 60 minutes, and I'm going to need to moving forward with the, you know, against these guys and. Over and time to hit the reset button and move on. Well, and that was the message. You know, number one was reset. We had to hit a reset button. We could, you know, losing the last two games the way we've lost them, you know, we felt like we really hurt ourselves. We shot ourselves in the foot against Ohio State, you know, when we went up 12-10 and, you know, made just too many errors. And, you know, they won the game, they earned it, but we felt like we gave things away. And then, to be honest with you, we got throttled last weekend, plain and simple. So when you go home, you need to look yourself in the mirror as a coach, as a player. And we could have sulked about it, and we said we needed to hit the reset button, and we needed to forget it, move on, and then be better. And I thought we did that. I don't know that we had a great week of practice. I really don't. And I think it showed early on in the game. But important win. In a great environment, in a great rivalry, and one that I hope our guys understand how privileged we are to be a part of it. Well, I would tell you, my sense was they wanted to milk the clock a little bit and, you know, whittle the clock down to late in the possession. And you saw, I mean, they did a tremendous job of that early in the game. I think they had three or four goals, you know, when there was 15 seconds left in the clock, and they whittled it down to two, three, or 4 seconds. And they're backbreakers defensively. So I think that was part of it. I think the other part was I thought we did a good job defensively. I think they helped us a couple times with some turnovers that are uncharacteristic of them. I'm sure we won't see them on those on Thursday. But a good solid job by our defense in a game they needed to step up and stand tall.
Dave, what changed after they got up 5-1?
We started to play. You know, what changed was defensively stop being selfish. And that's been our Achilles heel all year long. I mean, we've shown the propensity to be able to play good, solid defense. I mean, we held Michigan scoreless, I think it was 31 minutes, right? You know, we do a good job in the first half of Rutgers, who we saw today is a very good team. You know, and in the first, I guess, 12 minutes, we were selfish. We're late sliding to Fairman with a short stick on it. And how is that possible? We talked about that all week. So we did a better job of playing team defense and support. And that was the biggest difference defensively. Offensively, we finally shared the ball. You know, we've been holding the ball for too long, 8, 9, 10 seconds at a clip. And today we moved it and we let the ball do the work for us a little bit.
I think it was nice for our team to bounce back. As Coach said, we hit the reset button this past week after that loss to Penn State. And I think that was the best thing for this team. Our biggest thing was to get back to the defense we played last year, just loose, coming in with confidence. And although we didn't start that way this game and we were down early, that almost let us kind of loosen up a little bit and just say, all right, like, there's only one way out of this, and that's if we fight and if we trust each other. And I think that was the best thing that could have happened. And we ended up coming back, and it was a good start as far as transitioning into who we were last year, and it's going to be even more important week of practice.
It's pretty special, you know, walking out there with our guys, knowing the tradition, all the alums that have played in this game, you know, what it means to College Cross. It was pretty special, and, you know, I'm just happy to be a part of it.
Look, number one, none of us are owed anything. You know, it's our privilege to coach. It's theirs to play, and in life, you get the opportunity to be a part of something special. And in college athletics, you know, and in athletics in general, there are these rivalries that are bigger than all of us. You know, they're bigger than, you know, just one game. This isn't about just tonight. It's about all the games that have been played, you know, here or at Homewood Field. It's about all the players that have come before us. It's about the respect and reverence that our guys need to have for not only our players that played in it, but their players that have played in it and the great players that have played in it. And we find ourselves in something that's just far, far bigger than us. And I just hope that they understand that we're not guaranteed that. And not every program gets to be a part of, you know, one of the oldest, if not the oldest, and one of the fiercest rivalries in the sport of lacrosse. So my hope is they just understand how fortunate we are to be a part of it.
All right, just quickly wanted to touch on Penn State's 14-13 win over Rutgers in Happy Valley. Really impressed by the crowd and the environment at this stadium. You know, obviously a lot's been made of the debut and how new and fresh and impressive it is, and they filled it, and it was loud on Saturday afternoon. And for me, you know, if you're Rutgers, backs against the wall, not really in consideration for NCAA tournament selection, and so you got one way in, and this Penn State team has been a buzzsaw. You talked about their performance a week prior against Johns Hopkins, in which they put up 20 goals, and the Scarlet Knights came in, went toe-to-toe. They didn't back down. You know, I didn't necessarily think that they deserved to win, but there's no question that they played well enough to win. And as a result, I feel like if you're Brian Brecht, you feel good about your team's chances heading into the Big Ten semifinals.
Yeah, you know, Rutgers is going to get one of these games one of these days. I just don't know if I'm going to be alive to see it. Penn State, kind of, you could see this one coming. You know, they put a lot into that Hopkins game, so a slight regression of their form is not surprising. Love the crowd. Chris Hogan was back on campus for that, and they'll get a home game in the first round of the playoffs. And being the one seed is a big deal, obviously, because you play the winner of the 16-17 AQ play-in game. So there is a one seed. It's different from being a two. Okay, there's benefits with being the one. So You know, I continue to be impressed with Penn State. Their numbers, they're are gigantic. I mean, they lead the country in all those stat categories we talked about. Their RPI is, what, 3 points higher. You know, they're just on a different planet right now.
Let's go ahead and hear from goalie Colby Canese.
I've seen this before in the season where, you know, I didn't have my best game, but my coach and I always really talk. Like, it doesn't really matter about, you know, if it's my best game or because it's not about me, it's about the team. So, you know, the way to make up for that, if you're having, you know, playing poorly or something, finish strong, make sure you have your team's back in the end. If we win, it's a lot better than, you know, your own individual stats. So, I really care less if not, if, you know, my save percentage goes down whatsoever, you know, as long as I did what was best for the team in the end, like, it's good.
What were you seeing just in that final moment?
I mean, we've been in it before. We were in it with Penn. And I just, we were calm. We just kind of, I think, have developed a, you know, sort of like feel that, you know, we're not going to freak out at the end of games when it gets tight or close. It's not before. We're a team, a defense has been to get with each other for the past 3 years. So we're comfortable with where we are, and we just kind of know we can look at that and be like, all right, we got this.
With today's win for you guys, you'll now play Rutgers again in the first game of the Big Ten tournament. What sort of challenges does it present that they know what you guys have, but, you know, does it sort of help or hurt that you played them today and it was such a grueling back-and-forth game?
I mean, I think it does both, helps and hurt. It can help and it can hurt. I mean, you know, I don't really think we're going to change anything dramatically, but I know that we'll be ready, and we're excited to get back in there.
All right, Quint, as we wind down, just want to quickly wrap up Friday's action. We saw the America East get its number one seed and host determined after a two-hour lightning delay, featured Stony Brook beating Albany 12-10. What a season Coach Jim Nagel's team has put together in the wake of, you know, I guess the right way for me to put it is that when this team, who got off to a decent start, lost to Hartford, so that made them 3-4. It was an America East loss. Hartford was winless on the season at that point on March 16th and had gone winless in the America East in 2018 as well. So they hadn't won a conference game in over a year. I was like, it was head-scratching. I was like, oh man, these Seawolves are in trouble. In retrospect, you look back, wins over Brown and Hofstra, losses to Penn State, Sacred Heart, Marist, and then a win over Bryant leading up to that loss against Hartford. Since then, they've gone 6-1 with a lone loss as an outlier to Princeton, and as I mentioned, 5-1 in the America East to set up a 1-4 matchup in the semifinals against UMBC. Really nice job out of the Seawolves to put together this season.
Yeah, that tournament's at Stony Brook. Okay, those games are Thursday, 4:30 and 7. The finals are Saturday noon at Stony Brook on ESPNU. Okay, America's finals going to be on ESPNU. But if you're a Long Island lacrosse fan, go out and support those two semifinal games, Albany, Vermont, UMBC, Stony Brook. And you can watch that game on America East TV.
So,
Big East, Denver. Yeah, yes. let's just go rapid fire through some of these leagues, Terry. And I don't really have, you know, wouldn't surprise me if Albany came back and won that league. When we talk about the Big East, it wouldn't surprise me. The only surprise would be Providence winning the league. They obviously finished up the season on a high note. They're playing a good brand of ball with Tate Boyce, their goalie. They play Georgetown Thursday. Nova plays Denver Thursday. CBS Sports Network has both of those games. And then their final Saturday, CBS Sports Network, that's from Denver.
Yeah, so those games are late, 6:30 and 9.
Denver's always struggled in the league tournament. So, you know, let's see what happens. Georgetown won it last year. Nova's won, Marquette's done well in that tournament. They're not in it this year, so I don't know what to think.
In the Patriot League, we knew that Loyola had locked up the one seed. They beat Lafayette in a relatively insignificant game, 15-4 on Friday night. The most important result was Navy over Boston University, 13-12. However, because Holy Cross beat Lehigh 12-7, the Mountain Hawks are the number two seed. Because Holy Cross won that game, it created a tie. The Midshipmen were on the outside as a result. And as a result of that, the quarterfinals are set. Army hosts Holy Cross, and Boston University hosts Bucknell. As I mentioned, Loyola and Lehigh are the top two seeds.
Yeah, that's a Tuesday, Friday, Sunday format, 16 bracket. Loyola hosts semis. on Friday and Sunday. Those games on Friday, 5 and 8. You'll see Loyola at 5, Lehigh at 8, and then Sunday noon, CBS Sports Network, the Patriot League Championship game. Okay, Loyola, I think, is in whether they win the AQ or the at-large. There's a lot of teams who are hoping that they can snag the AQ and not be needed for an at-large pick. But I want to send a shout-out to the Crusaders of Holy Cross because they've had a fabulous, fabulous season. Really one of the best in school history. But congratulations to those guys, and good luck in the tournament.
So two to go. The CAA tournament will be at UMass. The Minutemen will take on Drexel, and Towson will take on Delaware in the semifinals.
It's a Thursday-Saturday format. LSN has your coverage 5 and 7:30 Thursday night. Garber's Gorillas against Drexel. Delaware-Towson, that's a huge game. And, you know, in that league, Towson's got an at-large resume that puts them on the bubble. But, man, winning the AQ would certainly take that out of the equation. UMass is the hot team in the league. Again, slow start. And what are they, like 9-1 in their last 10 games? You can watch that championship game Saturday, 1 o'clock, LSN. UMass is the favorite. Sean Scannone, you called that. You called that, Foy. Foy, you're on fire, man. You need to go to Vegas. He's like 63%. He's got guys by 5 percentage points, and he's making a boatload of saves. By the way, it's like he's averaging 15 saves a game at 63%.
He's playing really well. There's no doubt about it. In the NEC, Mount St. Mary's will host. They will host Robert Morris as the 1 seed versus 4 seed matchup, and Hobart will take on Sacred Heart in the nightcap. That one from Emmitsburg, also a Thursday-Saturday format.
Saturday at 4, NEC front row for that game. And there's one more we left out, Terry. Don't forget.
The Mac.
Don't forget about our friends at the Mac.
Yep. So Quinnipiac takes on Detroit Mercy in one semifinal. Marist takes on Canisius in the other.
At Marist, the beautiful Hudson Valley campus. I got to see if my mom wants to go to that game. Thursday, 4 and 7. That's ESPN Plus for Mac games. The finals, Saturday, 10 a.m. Rise and shine. It's breakfast at the Mac finals. Marist, ESPNU, Saturday, 10 a.m.
Quint, this is the best time of year. Send us off with something to savor.
Only degenerate gamblers will bet a Mac or NEC playoff game.
And we all are degenerate gamblers. If you're listening to if you listen to a lacrosse podcast on Monday morning, that means that you want some action
in
these games.
I'm going to New York City, and I have a hotel overlooking Central Park. So I am the luckiest man on earth. I'm so pumped for this week.
As always, thank you for the listen. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and a review. Hit us up on Twitter. He's at Q Kesnick. I'm at Terrence Foy. We are at @inside_lacrosse. Come back tomorrow to check out the In the Crease podcast with Dan Abern and Kyle Devitt. I assume they'll have something to say about Avengers Endgame and Battle of Winterfell. And, of course, they'll have a lot of lacrosse to discuss. Quint, until next week. Next week, we're going to be talking about the Derby, too.
Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check, testing 1, 2, 3, poke check, rap check, back check, slap check.
Welcome to the Quick Restart. We cover 73 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
And we do it fast.